Okay. So I was starting to talk about major course topic number one, which is protecting a long series of messages against forgery and eavesdropping, assuming that the sender and receiver share a long secret. Now, I've simplified that picture down to protecting one message using a fairly short secret. Here's the picture of the protected protocol. There is, at the top of the picture, a message generator whose entire role in life is to generate one message, M, and then die. Then the message M is handed off to a sender responsible for the cryptographic side of this protocol. The sender uses some secrets, R and S, in order to compute an authenticator, an authentication tag, a message authentication code, A. Sometimes people say that A is the message authentication code, or being more careful, say that the function from M to A determined by R and S is the message authentication code. This A is a short extra string which authenticates M, protecting it against forgery by the network. The network is the untrusted party here. The attacker lives inside the network. The network provides some M prime and A prime to a receiver who knows the same secret. Nobody else knows the secret, R and S. The network can change the message M, can change the authenticator A, providing a new M prime and A prime. The receiver will recompute the A prime that should have been there from M prime, and if it matches, then will accept M prime and A prime. For instance, if the network transmits the message without changing it, then the receiver will accept it. If, on the other hand, the network does change the message, then hopefully the receiver will throw it away. To review the definitions of the pieces of this here, the messages M are polynomials in one variable. Over the prime field Z mod P, with an extra restriction that their constant coefficients are zero. Let me remind you that P is the particular prime 2^130 - 5. Those of you who've been thinking about the security have surely noticed that all I care about for Z mod P is that it's a field. Any sufficiently large field will work just fine here, but you might consider further generalizations, like instead of evaluating elements of this polynomial ring at various random points, instead of reducing elements of this ring modulo primes, irreducibles of the form X minus R, what if you have higher degree irreducibles and reduce the field size accordingly? What if you have higher dimensional rings? There's lots of generalizations of this, a few of which I'll talk about when I talk about competitors to this function. Then M prime is another message. It has the same constraints enforced by the receiver that it's a polynomial with M prime having constant coefficient zero. What are R and S? Well, those are the secrets shared by the receiver, which are random elements of Z mod P. Both of them are uniform, means every possibility is equally likely. 1 over P chance of any possibility for R, 1 over P chance of any possibility for S, and they're independent. In other words, the pair R, S is uniform over all the P squared possibilities for numbers between 0 through P minus 1. For pairs of those numbers, R, S has a 1 over P squared chance of any particular achieving any particular value in there. These are secrets shared by the sender and receiver. And then to complete reviewing the definition, A is computed as M evaluated at R plus S. Something so simple can be a provably secure authentication protocol for one message. And then the receiver does the same computation with M prime. The receiver discards M prime, A prime. Unless they satisfy the same equation, unless A prime is M prime of R plus S. If the network does not change M and A, then the receiver does not discard M prime and A prime. If M prime equals M and A prime equals A, then this is satisfied. I claim, however, that every attack strategy, every forgery attempt, every way to have M prime and A prime different from M and A has a negligible probability of success. Probability of success, negligible. That's what I ended off with last time, and I want to start today by reviewing attacks on this system. Let me emphasize these are forgery attacks. I'm not yet dealing with eavesdropping, and I'm not going to deal with traffic analysis, the other more advanced attacks that I mentioned, at least for today. So, what do you do if you're an attacker sitting in the middle of this and you want to try to fool the receiver into accepting some different message? Well, you lose if M prime equals M and A prime equals A. So the first thing, obviously, that an attacker should do is look at M and choose a different message. Hopefully, from the attacker's perspective, hopefully a message that does something bad to the receiver, but we're not sure how this is being applied, so we don't know what kind of messages M prime are useful for the attacker. Let's just say the attacker chooses, the network chooses some M prime different from M, and then chooses, let's say, a random A prime. Maybe that'll work. Chooses a uniform, random A prime. Clearly, the chance of this working is, well, the chance of this uniform random A prime, different, independent of everything else, is equal to some M prime of R plus S, which has chance 1 over P, 1 over 2 to the 130 minus 5. The probability that this attack succeeds, that this forgery succeeds, in other words, the probability that M prime comma A prime is different from MA, well, that's guaranteed, and that the A prime equals M prime of R plus S, this is, of course, 1 over P, 1 over 2 to the 130 minus 5, which is a very small number. We're not worried about the possibility of this attack succeeding. All right, let's do a better attack. Here's an attack with a higher probability of success. Suppose that the attacker looks at M and looks at A, and then chooses A prime equal to A, and then chooses M prime to maliciously have several, well, of course the attacker is malicious, to cleverly have several choices of R all work. Suppose that the attacker looks at M and A and chooses A prime equals A and M prime, polynomial M prime is M plus X times X minus 1 times X minus 2, which still satisfies the constant coefficient being 0. What's the chance that this attack succeeds? What's the chance that A prime is M prime of R plus S? Well, probability that this attack succeeds. As before, we know that M prime is not equal to M. Their difference is this non-zero polynomial, X minus 1, X minus 2. So the probability of success for the attacker is exactly the probability that the authenticator A prime works, that A prime equals M prime of R plus S. And now let's plug in A prime is A and M prime is M plus something. Evaluate that at R. M prime of R, that's M of R plus R times R minus 1 times R minus 2, and then add S to it. And hey, this is almost something that's guaranteed to be true. If we subtract off A equals M of R plus S, this is, oh, oops, there's this extra term here, probability that R times R minus 1 times R minus 2 is equal to 0. And there are, of course, three choices of R for which R times R minus 1 times R minus 2 is 0. Three choices of R modulo P. R is, again, an element of Z mod P, which for me is just defined as 0 through P minus 1 with the usual ring operations. This probability of R being R times R minus 1 times R minus 2 being 0 is just the probability that R equals 0, 1, or 2, which is 3, out of the 2 to the 130 minus 5 uniform random possibilities. You can also see from this type of analysis what would happen if R were somewhat non-uniform and the attacker, instead of choosing 0, 1, 2 here, chose, well, I'll say what you do without 0 in a moment, but whatever the choices for R are that the attacker implicitly puts into this choice of M prime, well, if he chooses the most likely R's, then he gets all of those R's, whatever their chances of showing up, he gets all of those R's to make his attack work. And this probability of success is the probability that those R's show up. So this, more generally, what the attacker can do is choose A prime and M prime so that the relationship between the original authenticator equation, A equals M of R plus S, and the desired equation, A prime equals M prime of R plus S, that the difference between those has lots of roots R. The attacker chooses, what do we need? We need M prime minus A prime to be M minus A plus, stick in some non-zero constant if you like, times X minus some guesses for R. Let's say G1, G2, etc. through GL. G sub capital L there. Maybe I should emphasize that the G should be distinct. No point in repeating a number here. And of course, for any choices of G1 through GL, the attacker can simply add that X minus G1, X minus G2, etc. through X minus GL product to M minus A, and then that is some, uniquely, that is some polynomial M prime with constant coefficient 0 minus some A prime. So he chooses A prime as the negative of the constant coefficient and chooses M prime as the rest of the polynomial on the right side here. What is the chance that this attack succeeds? What's the chance that A prime equals M prime of R plus S? Well, subtracting off A equals M of R plus S, you see that the probability of the attack succeeding is exactly the probability that R minus G1 times R minus G2 times et cetera times R minus G sub L is equal to 0. And since P is a prime, since 2 to the 130 minus 5 is a prime, this is the probability that R is one of G1 through GL. Which is exactly, since the G's are distinct, L over 2 to the 130 minus 5. And maybe I should emphasize at the end here, this is using the fact that 2 to the 130 minus 5 is a prime. If I had a composite number 2 to the 130 minus 5, then maybe I could have lots of factors there conspiring to have product 0. There could be many more R's such that that product is 0. Exercise for various choices, well, for arbitrary factorizations of 2 to the 130 minus 5, well, if you replace this by arbitrary integers and then look at their factorizations, how many R's exactly have R minus G1, et cetera, times R minus GL being 0 for the attacker's selection, the worst case of G1 through GL? All right, so for our primes, the only way for these products to be 0 is for R to be one of the minuses in the factors for R to be G1, G2 through GL, which has chance L over 2 to the 130 minus 5. And when I write this L, you should be thinking that's the degree of the messages. At least it's the maximum degree of M prime and M, which is presumably limited by the network. It's limited by your transmission time. Maybe the sender and receiver, well, the receiver is the important part, explicitly limit how long messages can be, which put a limit on L. Even if they don't, there's some limit on how long they're listening to communication, and that dictates how effective this attack is. Let me pause for a moment and ask, does anybody have a better attack? Or another attack? Or the same attack expressed in a different way. Here's a thought. If I crossed out the S from this protocol, if I crossed out plus S, equivalently if I say S equals 0, if I just specify everybody's going to use this choice of S, then you should be able to think of a better attack where somebody just looks at the equation, somebody looks at M and A, and knows A equals M of R, and then solves for R. There's only a few roots of that equation. Depending on the degree of M, there's at most, say, L roots of the equation. If M has degree, at most L. But putting in the plus S somehow seems to stop that leak of information, or does it? Well, actually, it does. This attack is the best attack, thanks to the plus S. This attack is optimal. Usually in cryptography, people write down some cryptographic protocol and then say, well, here's the attacks we can think of, and then conjecture that those are the best attacks or close to the best attacks. In information theoretic cryptography like this, there's no conjectures running around. There's no guesses. You can simply prove that this attack is the best attack on the system. There is no way for an attack strategy to figure out an M prime and A prime that has a better chance of success than the strategy that I've shown here. This L over 2 to the 130 minus 5, where L is the maximum degree of your messages, in particular the maximum degree of M and M prime, which is something, again, the receiver can just constrain. That L over 2 to the 130 minus 5 is the maximum possible attack success probability. I want to spend a few blackboard pieces here on proving this for you. Let me emphasize what I'm claiming about the attacks. Every attack, ones that we've thought of here or anything else you might think of or anything that exists, every attack has the probability of a successful forgery being less than or equal to L over 2 to the 130 minus 5, where L is, by definition, the maximum message degree. Let me focus informally on what the critical points are in the proof and then say what you have to do if you want to formalize it. The critical point is what I was saying a moment ago about whether M and A leak any information, and S hides all the information about R. The relationship between S and R is known, but to be precise, the attacker learns nothing about R. From seeing that authenticated message, M, A. And the reason for this is that every choice of R, whatever the distribution of R is, well, I've said it's uniform, but whatever the distribution is, every choice of R from that distribution is consistent with exactly one S. Each R is consistent with exactly one S. Namely, what was A again? It was M of R plus S, so S is A minus M of R. Out of the P squared possibilities for the pair R, S, the attacker, if he likes, can spend a lot of computer time. Well, this is an insane amount of computer time, but I haven't said anything about the attacker's computer power. Even with the world's best inconceivable computers, the attacker can't break this protocol. He could make a list of all the possible pairs R, S that work. Given M and A, he can make a list of 2 to the 130 minus 5 P possibilities for R, and for each one, there's one possibility for S. So he knows nothing about R. He just knows the relationship between R and S. And what does he then do? Well, he writes down some M prime and A prime, and let's suppose that that works and conclude that something extremely unlikely has happened. Let's assume that the message M prime is different from M, or, well, equivalently, M prime A prime is different from M, A. And let's assume that A prime and M prime pass verification. A prime is equal to M prime of R plus S. Well, subtracting that from what we know about the legitimate authenticator, A equals M of R plus S, we see that A prime minus A equals M prime of R minus M of R. And therefore, R is a root of the polynomial that showed up exactly the same one as in the attack, whatever the difference is between M prime minus M and A prime minus A. So some polynomial over the same field Z mod P. This polynomial, I claim, is non-zero. Here's where it's critical that the messages M and M prime are required to have constant coefficient zero. If you evaluate this polynomial at zero, then what happens? M prime is 0, 0, M is 0, 0. So you see that if this polynomial were 0, then A prime would have to equal A. The value of this polynomial at 0 is A prime of 0 minus A of 0. Well, A prime and A are constants. That's just A prime minus A. If the polynomial is 0, then thanks to M prime and M having constant coefficient 0, A prime has to equal A, which then means that M prime equals M, contradicting the assumption that we have a forgery. So this polynomial is non-zero if there's a successful forgery. And it's also not very big degree. It has degree at most L, and therefore it has at most L roots. It has less than or equal to L roots. Here I'm again using that P is prime. Therefore, the probability of success is exactly the probability that R, which again the attacker doesn't know anything about, so he can't use it in constructing M prime and A prime, the probability that R is one of these roots is exactly the probability of success. The probability of a successful forgery is less than or equal to L divided by the number of possibilities for R. And again, if R has a somewhat non-uniform distribution, there was a question about that last time, then you easily adapt the answer here to say, well, whatever the maximum L possibilities are, the most common L possibilities for R, presumably the attacker can guess what those, the best attack will be the attack that guesses those values of R, and then its probability of success is the sum of the probabilities of those choices of R, which, assuming R is uniformly distributed, is exactly L over 2 to the 130 minus 5. If there's some bias, then it'll be bigger than this. But I was assuming that R is uniformly distributed. All right. If you want to formalize this, for those of you who are interested in doing proofs in this topic and were paying attention when I said things like measurable functions yesterday, you can look at this picture and say, well, okay, the attacker is something we can specify by a function that's slightly too simple. Sometimes people talk about deterministic attackers. Those are functions from MA to M prime A prime with typically some restrictions on how complicated the functions can be, but in any case, there's a function from MA to M prime A prime. That deterministic notion of an attacker as a function ignores the fact that the attacker can flip coins, which doesn't help because those coins are independent of everything else, but if you want to properly model every possible party, then what you say is that each party in the protocol is an algorithm . All that you do in this type of information theoretic proof is turn the algorithm into a function once you have the right list of inputs, so you don't have to really care what the meaning of an algorithm is. When you formalize non-information theoretic cryptography with runtime limits on your algorithms, then you have to define carefully what an algorithm is. But anyway, if you want to formalize, you start by saying every party is an algorithm. This algorithm gets two types of inputs. First of all, it's talking to the other parties. Algorithm receives inputs from the other parties according to the protocol. For instance, according to the picture that I've drawn here, the network is receiving inputs from the sender and the receiver is receiving inputs from the network. Then you might embed this in a larger picture where the network gets information back from the receiver, etc. The algorithm receives inputs from other parties, and it receives to properly model randomized algorithms. It receives, well, it can flip random coins, which means it receives as an input some random sequence of bits, uniform random bit sequence, uniform random sequence C1, C2, C3, etc. ad infinitum, uniform random sequence of coin flips, uniform random sequence of bits. These are traditionally called coin flips. The reason that this extra input doesn't help the attacker compared to doing a deterministic attacker who just is a function of the inputs from the other parties with no extra randomness that it generates, the reason is that these bits are independent of everybody else's bits. These are independent of the other parties' coin flips. Once you have this structure in place, then you easily formalize this proof, and you see the critical point is that the attacker's behavior is independent of R. That's what it means to learn nothing, is that your probability of any particular result is independent of R in the usual probability theory sense. The attacker, as an example of this party, the network, is a function from the inputs from other parties, and now we look at the protocol here. What I said a moment ago is just general purpose, how you model any protocol mathematically, and then in this particular protocol, the network has inputs M and A, and it has coin flips, bits C1, C2, etc., which together produce M prime and A prime. All of this is independent of R. A is a function of R and S and M, but it's still something that is independent of R. The probability of any particular pair of all those things I wrote down and R is the product of the probabilities of that choice of R and the probabilities of the things I wrote down. These inputs, M, A, C1, C2, etc., by hypothesis, these are all independent of R. R is a secret. It's a coin flip in the sender and receiver that other people don't get to see. These are independent of R. They're not independent of R and S, but they are independent of R. And therefore, the output, whatever you plug these independent of R things into, is something in also independent of R. M prime, A prime is independent of R. And now you easily finish the proof as before. You easily conclude that the informal logic is right. The probability of a successful attack, successful forgery, is less than or equal to the maximum degree of M and M prime divided by 2 to the 130 minus 5. So if anybody wants to write proofs in this area, then that's the kind of thing that you have to do. But, okay, I'm interested in this as an applied subject, not as an exercise in mathematics, so I'll just leave the probability theory at that and continue on to more aspects of Pauli 1305. There are several things I have to do for you. I want to talk about channel conversion, re-explain what this protocol is doing. I want to say what Pauli 1305 actually does. This is a simplified version of it, and there's certain real-world tweaks. And I want to talk about various things in the afternoon, like what do you do with multiple messages, and also as part of channel conversion, I have to tell you what to do about eavesdropping. Before I jump into any of that, any questions about the security of this simplified Pauli 1305 protocol? Okay. channel conversion. There is a prerequisite for this protocol. It's a very important prerequisite that the sender and receiver are sitting somewhere with these secrets, R and S, that you might reasonably ask, where did they came from? These didn't just appear out of nowhere. Somehow the sender and receiver must have created R and S. Now, I've said major course topics 2 and 3 are doing stuff with R and S, which will to some extent improve how this protocol works with R and S. But without doing the fancier protocols, for this protocol, you can reasonably ask, suppose you want to use this in practice, where do R and S come from? This protocol guarantees that forgeries are stopped, which doesn't mean every forgery fails, but it means that the probability of a successful forgery, no matter what the attacker does, is tiny. This protocol stops all forgeries, which, again, let me say, this means the probability of success is negligible. Probability of a forgery is negligible. But it places, the protocol places certain requirements on the sender and receiver. Requires the sender and receiver to have shared RNS. They have to start with some secrets, RNS. If you actually want to use this protocol or even understand what it could be doing for you, you should be asking, where did RNS come from? How did they agree on these secrets? How did they share these secrets? Well, one answer is to ignore the cryptographic side of things and fall back on a locked briefcase network or another physically secure network. For example, does anybody, by the way, spot some other chalk that's reasonably thin and white as opposed to a huge piece of chalk or colored? There's an outside blackboard. Okay, let me pop out there for just 5 seconds. And here we have some more chalk. Okay. One answer is that the sender and receiver got together somewhere . Maybe they met privately out in the middle of the forest or in some secure basement. And then how did they generate the RNS? They flipped 260 coins. If your coin flipping skills are not up to snuff, then you might think it's a good idea to flip a coin a couple times and then merge the results into a single bit just in case there's some bias in your coin flips. You also have to watch out for the 260 coins producing an RNS that are not in the required range, 0 through P minus 1 each. There's, instead of 2 to the 260 possibilities for the coin flips, there's only 2 to the 260 minus something like, what is it, 10 times 2 to the 130? There's some coin flips that'll fail, so then you have to try again. Ignoring the details of how you generate a random pair of numbers, let's focus on the secrecy here. The sender and receiver could have met somewhere and generated RNS, and then they separate and can engage in this protocol. Maybe they used some other physically secure connection. Maybe they used my favorite example of a physically secure network, a locked briefcase, trusted courier, very expensive network. Or maybe they did something else. Ah, lots of chalk. Thank you very much. Maybe they used some other communication channel to communicate these RNS. One of them flipped the coins and sent it to the other one. But no matter what they did, they must have had some secure channel for RNS. They had some channel for communicating RNS, which is separate from this protocol. It can't be something the attacker was allowed to change. Some channel for communicating RNS. If the attacker is able to affect this channel to, for instance, eavesdrop on RNS or forge RNS, then all the security is lost. obviously this old channel, the one that communicated R and S, had to protect against eavesdropping, and it had to protect against forgery. Otherwise, the new protocol does not protect against anything. If the attacker sees RNS, for instance, then all hope of security is lost. This had to be secure against forgery and eavesdropping. Now, if you have that secure channel for communicating RNS, why don't you use it for communicating M? This is not a frivolous question. Why not use the old channel to communicate M? We've put together this mathematical protocol for protecting the authenticity of a message. But why did we do that? What was the point? Why did we build a new channel? A new channel to protect M against forgeries. New channel to communicate M. It seems like a step backwards to have an old channel which is protected against forgery and against eavesdropping, and evidently communicates arbitrary random data, RNS, and then somehow instead of just using that old channel to communicate our data, we've built a whole new channel which with, okay, not too much work, but somehow we've used this new channel to communicate data, protecting it against forgery and not against eavesdropping, so we've lost security. It seems like we've taken a step backwards and not actually achieved anything. There are frivolous answers to this, like, well, maybe the old channel was from the receiver to the sender, and there's no channel from the sender to the receiver, so the old channel's not usable. But in practice, channels are always two-way, so we could have used the old channel to communicate M as well. And actually, it's certainly true that the old channel could have been used to communicate data, but we do gain something. Am I up to my picture yet? Almost up to my picture. Okay. Generalized comments first. Certainly, it is true that we've lost some protection here. The new channel protects only against forgery. Which is not as good as the old channel. The old channel was better from a security perspective. But the new channel has two advantages. New channel has two important advantages over the old one. The first is that the new channel can communicate a lot more data. The old channel might have only existed for long enough to communicate these 260 bits. Communicating bits through a locked briefcase network, well, I've said you can stick a lot of bits into a locked briefcase, but in general, communicating bits through physically secure network is expensive, and you would like to reduce the amount of data you're sending through that, especially when I get some multiple messages and suddenly the data that we have to send through the old channel becomes a lot bigger. It's good to reduce the data that you need to send through the old channel, whereas the new channel can be a cheap radio network that transmits an arbitrarily long message. So the new channel, to summarize, expands bandwidth. New channel expands bandwidth. The message M can be much longer than RNS. The other advantage of the new channel is that it's new. The old channel might only have existed at some previous time, and now the new channel lets us do communication of new messages that we didn't have back when the old channel existed. Maybe you have your locked briefcases once a year, and then you use your locked briefcase data, RNS, to communicate messages through the entire year. The new channel takes the security of the old channel, at least some of it. New channel extends security through time. Which again reduces the costs of the old channel. You can have a locked briefcase network to transmit all your data, but the whole point of cryptography is to reduce the costs of securing our data. Question? Can we use RNS repeatedly? No. The protocol as it exists requires the message generator to die after one message, the sender similarly to die after one message, the receiver receives M prime and A prime and then either accepts it or discards it. You could have a receiver accept many messages from the network, and if you actually want to use a protocol to communicate many messages, then, well, wait for this afternoon when I talk about how to do multiple message communication. But this particular protocol, you're not allowed to reuse RNS. Now, maybe looking ahead to this afternoon, I guess there have been two questions already about what happens with reuse of RNS. When we have multiple messages, you could have separate R's and S's for every message, or what I'll get to is reusing R and then you have a separate S for every message, which reduces the amount of secret data you need by about a factor of two. But I'll get to all that this afternoon. Certainly for this protocol, do not reuse RNS, just like what you've heard about the one-time pad in first cryptography courses. You have to throw away your one-time data like this RNS after you've used it. In fact, I'm about to say the one-time pad, but let me first draw a picture of the channel conversion here. The old channel that we had, I'd like to summarize what's going on comparing the old channel and the new channel in this type of picture. The old channel was communicating, from the sender on the left to the receiver, or it could have been the other way. It had two security properties. It protected against forgery and against eavesdropping. In other words, it was a secret authenticated channel, which was used to send R and S, 260 bits, R and S, and let's convert that into internet terminology. That's something like 32 bytes, a little bit more, about 32 bytes of data. This is the old channel. If you have that old channel, then you produce a new channel. And what are the critical properties of the new channel? Well, it no longer protects secrecy of data. It just protects authenticity. On the top of the line there, the security properties have been reduced, but the message length that is transmitted can be much longer. M is something like, how big the degree of M? It's L, say, is our parameterized limit on how big the messages are, and then each coefficient of M is about 16 bytes, so let's say overall about 16 L bytes of data. And L can be pretty big. Let's say for an internet packet protocol, you might have L being 1,000 or so, and suddenly you've expanded your data by a factor of 1,000, well, 500. Or you might have M being much longer, like an email message, and set some limit L like 2 to the 30, and then there's an expansion factor by 2 to the 29. Aside from those changes above and below the line here, the secret being lost and the message size going up by whatever factor you want, although keep in mind the security here is also scaling, the probability of an attack is scaling with L. Aside from that change, the fact that we have a new channel versus an old channel is a basic advantage of the new channel, that it has extended security through time. All right, if I talk about channel conversion, I'm referring to this type of picture. What the protocol does for us is convert this old channel, some channel between the sender and receiver, the prerequisite channel, into the new channel. Let me draw a different picture for combining this with the one-time pad. if you want to protect the new channel against eavesdropping as well as forgery, easily combine with one-time pad to stop eavesdropping. Well, you just extend the secret data to include some numbers to add to your message. Your secrets are now R and S and then a bunch of T's, let's say T1, T2 through T sub L, same maximum message length. And then instead of sending M comma A, you send M with this T added to it, M1 plus T1. You don't have to send M0 because the bottom coefficient of M, because that's always 0. Send M1 plus T1, M2 plus T2, etc., continuing through ML plus TL if you like to have all your messages be L words long, L chunks long, or you could truncate this at the actual message length if you're not worried about traffic analysis seeing the length of your messages. ML plus TL, let's just say for simplicity, comma A. Either way, it protects secrecy of the message, protects the contents independently of the message length. Whatever is revealed about the message length, whether you truncate this or not, you are hiding each of the M's by adding some uniform random T to it, independent of all the other secrets. And then A, which is M of R, maybe I should write the fact that A is M of R plus S exactly as before, that protects the authenticity of your message. The receiver recomputes the authenticator given M prime, well, given the some ciphertext C1, C2, etc. through CL, and some A prime, the attacker first subtracts off the legitimate T's, producing a purported message, and then tries checking that against the authenticator. There's various ways to flip this around, different combinations of the you could first add the T's and then evaluate it R. That has some advantages, which I will get back to in the stream cipher context. All right, in any case, this is combining the protocol, the simplified Poly 1305, with a one-time pad, which protects each of the M's against being understood. Just as the R is independent of what the attacker sees, now all the M's are independent of what the attacker sees. The attacker has no information about M1 through ML. Those are all independent of the ciphertext. So this protects against eavesdropping as well as forgery, but it also has an interesting impact on the old channel. It requires that we have a lot more secret data being communicated. So this loses the first advantage of the new channel. We no longer have an expansion of bandwidth of the new channel compared to the old one. I'll draw a picture in a moment. But we do keep the second advantage. We do extend security through time, which is useful by itself. I guess I didn't have to erase this quite yet, but oh well, too late. Let me draw a picture and then take a drink and then finish up for the morning. Question? You mean why do you also have to, if I understood the question, it was why not throw away the A here and just have the M1 plus T1 through ML plus TL? Okay, the reason for that is that an attacker can look at that and, for instance, add 1 to the M1 plus T1. And now he's succeeded in modifying your message. And that could do quite a lot of damage. The attacker doesn't know what M1 through ML are, but maybe he has some guesses, and maybe even without knowing what they are, changing the message does some damage. In order to stop that by throwing in the A, well, if you change M1 or change M1 plus T1, then you also have to adjust your A by, say, R, which the attacker doesn't know. So by including A here, you prevent the attacker from getting any forgeries through. Sometimes people distinguish between selective forgeries, where the attacker knows exactly what effect he's going to have on the message and can, in fact, choose an entire message, which he chooses to have the maximum possible damage in whatever application, and then random forgeries, non-selective forgeries. And certainly protecting the secrecy of your data implies that there are no selective forgeries. Well, at least for the one-time pad, there are no selective forgeries. But there are lots of ways that people can do this type of forgery and cause lots of damage. For instance, suppose that the distribution of messages consists of the first half of it is some instructions to your bank, like deposit, pay $1,000 to somebody, and then the second half of it is some secret account information, say, which the attacker doesn't know. The attacker will never figure it out, but he can still change M1 and suddenly change $1,000 into $2,000, and that's unacceptable. That's doing damage, which is stopped by including the authenticator and protecting against forgery with this extra little computation of evaluating at R. All right, let me quickly draw the revised channel picture here. Well, everything I'm saying is orthogonal. Okay, the one of the parties here, if you formalize this or think about what it means in practice to actually generate messages, you have some algorithm that's the message generator, which based on its random bits, or maybe you embed this in a larger protocol, maybe based on inputs from somebody else, the message generator produces some message, which will probably have some randomness in it. If it doesn't have any randomness, then okay, the attacker can presumably just look at the software for the message generator and see the message that it produces. But if it has some randomness, if it's generating some random message, then the attacker doesn't know that random message. And it could still be non-uniformly distributed. I've never said anything about what the distribution of M is. Everything that I've said is orthogonal to the distribution of M. M could have, for instance, the first half of it being predictable and the second half of it being unpredictable. And in that case, secrecy would mean that the attacker can't figure anything out about M. Well, this absolute form of secrecy where the attacker, what the attacker sees is independent of M, that means that the distribution of M's that the attacker sees conditionally on what the attacker, the conditional distribution of M given the view of the attacker is the same as the distribution of M without the attacker seeing this ciphertext. That's something which, okay, that's what it means to protect against secrecy, and that's guaranteed without the A here, but it doesn't protect against forgery, where, again, everything that I've been talking about certainly allows the messages to have structure, and the messages could look like, and in lots of practical protocols do look like, some meaningful stuff followed by some secret stuff. For instance, again, a password or an account number along with some structured, interesting instructions, some data which, if you change it, causes damage. And I certainly would not want my cryptography to be usable only for random messages. I don't know why anybody would want to communicate random, meaningless messages. People typically do communicate messages which have some structure. And then if, for instance, the structure looks like the first half is instructions, pay $1,000, and the second half is your account number, then the attacker can do all sorts of damage by changing that message, by changing the first part of it, even without being able to break the secrecy of the second part. All right, let me finish with the channel picture here, and then I really do want some water and see if I can finish off a little more about Pauli 1305. Namely, I've said it's simplified. I want to do the tweaks, but let me finish the eavesdropping discussion with the revised channel conversion, which, again, I like these pictures for capturing what has been achieved by a protocol in a memorable way that if you look at this picture, you should be able to say, okay, here's what the protocol is doing for me without going through the details of it. The communication of a secret in the one-time pad plus simplified authenticator context, the secrets, once again, have to be communicated through a secret authentic channel. Difference from before is that now there's lots of secrets, R, S, and T, which together are something like, well, even longer than 16L bytes, or more like, well, 16 times L plus 2 bytes. That's the old channel. And then the new channel is communicating data, again, from the sender to the receiver, or you could have two-way communication, which now protects secrecy as well as authenticity. By putting in the T's, we're protecting the secrecy of M, absolutely protecting them. Again, no conjectures here. The distribution of M is independent of what the attacker can see. this new channel is now secret and authentic, critical difference from before, and communicates about 16 L bytes of the message, along with a little overhead, has to communicate the A as before, but the data that you can choose to transmit through this is 16 L bytes in the message M. Maybe a little bit more in that, because 2 to the 130 minus 5 instead of 2 to the 128, maybe a little bit less because the top coefficient has to be non-zero, but okay, about 16 L bytes in the message. And you can see this channel conversion now has about the same bandwidth in the two channels. If L is big, almost exactly the same bandwidth, the same security properties, secrecy and authenticity. The advantage of the new channel is that it's new. It extends security through time. All right, I'm happy to answer more questions about this, but first I want to get some water, so let's take a 3-minute break, and I see a pointer. Water. Oh, great, there's water right here. Okay, in that case, maybe we'll take a shorter break. Or does anybody want a 2-minute break? Water. Good stuff. Who invented this? All right, I didn't see any hands for a 2-minute break, and my throat is feeling a little bit better. So let me pause again and make sure that I answered all the questions about the channel conversion and also this combination with the one-time pad. What I wanted to jump into next was tweaks to this protocol that converted into the real Pauli 1305 and not this simplified, cleanest mathematical version. Okay. Real world tweaks. Some of these are more than tweaks. They're specifications which you really need in order to implement the protocol, in order to use it. The actual Pauli 1305 has three critical differences. From the protocol that I've shown you, the simplified A equals M of R plus S. I want to go through why there are the differences, what the differences exactly are, and then at one point I'll have to redo a bit of the security analysis. First important fact about the internet is that people do not communicate strings of integers modulo p. I've seen many interesting statements of what it is that a network communicates, for instance, octet sequences, or back in the old days, what modems communicated in terms of baud was a rather fascinating concept. But in any case, nobody ever, to my knowledge, designed a network whose role in life was to communicate integers modulo 2 to the 130 minus 5. The internet actually communicates strings of bytes. Internet messages are byte strings. A byte is an integer between 0 and 255. Let me put in parentheses here. You take Z mod 256 star, that's one way to say the set of strings, finite length strings, over Z mod 256, integers between 0 and 255 in each component. Internet messages are not strings, well, polynomials of polynomials in one variable over Z mod p for this prime p equals 2 to the 130 minus 5. Now, in some sense, this might seem like, okay, it's a little encoding issue. You can immediately answer the question that I'm asking here of how do you convert byte strings into, how do you encode, let me use the notation here, Z mod 256 star, how do you map byte strings injectively? Here I'm using the arrow with a little hook on the end for, has to be a one-to-one function from byte strings to polynomials. Of course, if you had two messages that gave the same output, that would allow a trivial forgery that the attacker could change an authenticator on one of the messages into just reuse it as an authenticator on the other message. So this has to be a one-to-one map for security. And you could trivially answer this by saying, well, look, a string of bytes, there's two differences between the left and right sides here. One is that we've got a Z mod 256 instead of a Z mod P, but okay, an integer between 0 and 255 can be regarded as an integer modulo P. That's certainly injective so far. And then, oops, there's one other consideration, which is that byte strings know how long they are. If you append a 0 to a byte string, then it's a different byte string, whereas a polynomial, if you append a 0 past the leading term, then it's the same polynomial. And in order to prevent appending zeros to byte strings, in order to prevent that from giving the same polynomial, you have to somehow mark how long the byte string is in your polynomial. For example, take your byte string and append a 1 to it, and then regard that as a polynomial, the 1 turning into the leading coefficient of the polynomial, the degree of the polynomial now revealing the length of the byte string, and then you read off the other coefficients. So this question is trivial to come up with an answer to. Just specifying some injective function here is easy. However, from a speed perspective, you don't want the trivial answers. You want to do a better job of packing your strings into polynomials. Poly 1305, well, let me describe what it does. It uses the following function. It breaks a byte string into something that fits pretty well into 2 to the 130 minus 5, namely 128-bit, in other words, 16-byte chunks. And now there's a little problem that byte string lengths are not necessarily multiples of 16. In fact, most strings that I've looked at in my life, not all, have not been multiples of 16 bytes in length. So maybe there's a final chunk whose length is between 1 and 15. So now each chunk has between 1 and 16 bytes, and the final chunk is the only one allowed to have less than 16 bytes. Ah, yes, Poly 1305 does more to these chunks. It takes each chunk, and then to indicate the length of the chunk, which is particularly an issue for the last one, and also to conveniently handle the appending zero issue, Poly 1305 appends a 1 to each chunk. And then views the result as an integer. There are several ways to treat byte strings as integers. I'm going to specify here little endian as opposed to big endian form for converting a byte string to an integer. Uses the little, oh yes, I should have said instead of each chunk, let me say the ith chunk so I can give it a name in a moment. Let's say that the uses little endian form for the ith chunk with a 1 appended to it to make an integer which has 129 bits, and I'll call that now C sub I, and then finally builds a polynomial, and the one last tweak from what you might initially think is that the polynomial is flipped into reverse order from what you would perhaps most simply write down. Poly 1305 builds the polynomial. What's convenient for computation is to have C1, the first chunk being the leading coefficient. Take C1 times x, add C2, multiply by x, and then add C3 and multiply by x, and keep going like this and do a final multiplication by x. And now this is reduced modulo p, which doesn't do anything to the coefficients because each of them is just a 129-bit integer between 0 and 2 to the 129 minus 1 is the maximum. This does satisfy the constraint of the polynomial has to have constant coefficient 0, and I guess I'll leave the picture up there. Let me give an example of this conversion. And I had some particular, was it 18-byte example to illustrate what's going on here, which had the virtue that I could do it in my head. Suppose that you have the 18-byte message three comma one comma lots of zeros, And then did I take a 7 for my next one? I guess I could have chosen anything, but just in case I want to double check this again, so I guess I didn't do the actual numerical calculation, so I'll be fine with 7, 0. This is a string of length 18. Z mod 256 to the 18, set of vectors of length 18 of integers modulo 256, the ones you see here, all rather small, actually between 0 and 7, mostly zeros. The 17th byte is a 7, 18th is a 0, first bytes are 3 and 1. Chop this into 16-byte chunks. There's one 16-byte chunk, and then, oops, no more 16-byte chunks. There's a 2-byte chunk. This is converted into... There are two chunks now, C1 and C2, so the final polynomial is C1x plus C2 times x, where what are C1 and C2? Well, the first chunk is take the first 16 bytes, 3, 1, 0, 0, 0, 0, and then put a 1 on the end, which is going to distinguish chunks of shorter length from chunks of the right length. Stick a 1 on the end, so that is now what in little endian form? Little endian means you start from the left and then take the first number times 1 plus the next number times 256 plus the next number times 256 squared, etc. So C1 is, to summarize, 3 plus 1 times 256 plus lots of zeros times 256 squared cubed, etc., until finally you get to 256 to the 16th. I stuck a 1 onto the end of the chunk. 1 times 256 to the 16th, that is C1, which is multiplied by x and another x, total x squared. And what about C2? C2 is the chunk 70 with a 1 stuck on the end. That's 701. 7 plus 256 squared in little endian form times x. That's C2 times x. Another trivial example of the conversion is that if you take the 0-byte message, there are no chunks at all. The 0-byte message is converted into 0. And similarly, well, I hope this example is sufficiently illustrative of the general procedure. You take 16 bytes out of your message, stick a 1 on the end, which usually means adding 2 to the 128, in other words, 256 to the 16th, to whatever number you've just picked up, regarded in little endian form, and then multiply that by x, and then add the next chunk, converted in the same way. In the final chunk, you add 256 to the some smaller number. If there is a final chunk of shorter length, then you indicate that length by adding 256 to the smaller number, that number being the number of bytes in the final chunk. All right, clearly this function is injective. Well, when you're writing a serious cryptographic paper, sometimes you say, oh yeah, clearly this is injective, and then somebody says, whoops, you forgot about the following case, and actually your protocol is trivially breakable. So it's important to write down proofs of this carefully. This function, this encoding, is injective. It's one-to-one. Different messages do produce different polynomials. Working backwards from the polynomial, you can see how many chunks there were from the degree of the polynomial. Let me emphasize that all the C sub i's are non-zero because we stuck a 1 into them. Each of the C sub i's looks like some chunk of length at most 16 plus this 1 turns into at most 2 to the 128 for a total of at most 2 to the 129 minus 1. An integer between, I guess the smallest possible would be something like 256 would be the smallest possible C sub i, and the largest is 2 to the 129 minus 1. Reducing those modulo p doesn't do anything. You get all these non-zero numbers. By looking at how many of those non-zero numbers there are, the degree of the polynomial, you see the number of chunks, and then extracting the chunks from the encoding here as an integer, well, that's just decoding the integer. In base 256, its representation is exactly the bytes of the chunk with some leading one that you throw away to recover the original message. Somehow this sort of thing turns into an entire half page of a paper, but well, okay, this is how to encode messages in Poly 1305, where again, all the details here are for speed reasons. It's important to realize that the choices made in designing a real-world high-speed cryptographic function come from, we want the functions to be secure and go as quickly as possible. Compared to the encoding here, this encoding is much tighter, produces much lower degree polynomials. You encode 16 bytes as one chunk of the polynomial. There's one multiplication here for every 16 bytes of your input message rather than for every byte, and that's quite a significant speed up. You can compensate somewhat for that if you know that all the coefficients of your message are small, but there's no way to make this function run as quickly as the function here. Similarly, the details of sticking a 1 onto a chunk versus other methods you might come up with for encoding chunks of a message as integers, those are for speed reasons. The reversal of the C's here is for speed reasons. All the particular choices here are to make this function run quickly. When I talk about the speed of the function, then we will see some nice results for how fast this function is, and then if you were to change the function, you would not get as nice results. So that's the reason for all the particular choices. What is my second tweak for Poly 1305? Yes, 130 bits. Anybody here who's done internet programming does not like the concept of 130-bit chunks. R, S, and A are 130-bit objects, each 130 bits, which really annoys the programmer. The reason for this is that typically if people want to send data inside if people want to send data inside an internet packet, then they'll take that data and then try to stick it somewhere in the packet where it will fit as a sequence of bytes, or in fact people want to have words if possible, 4-byte chunks or even 8-byte chunks to try to align the packet nicely. They don't want to be packing all sorts of data and trying to find extra bits here and there. 130 bits is a little bigger than 128 bits, 16 bytes. 16 bytes is a nice number. 16 bytes plus 2 bits is the sort of thing that really annoys real-world programmers. A moment ago, having 130 being bigger than 128 was quite convenient for packing these byte strings reasonably efficiently without having to go to a lot of work to get essentially all of the 130 bits used. But now if you want to generate or communicate 130-bit objects like the authenticator A, then people say, ah, geez, can't you make it 128 bits? And yes, of course, you can. Poly 1305 actually changes the function a little bit. R, instead of being a uniform random number modulo P, is restricted to the range 0, 1 through 2 to the 128 minus 1, which conveniently comes out of all sorts of real-world primitives for producing 128 random-looking bits. S, similarly, is in the range 0 to 2 to the 128 minus 1. And A changes to something which is a slightly different formula and only 2 to the, between 0 and 2 to the 128 minus 1, 16 bytes. A is exactly the following. Take M of R, as before, but instead of adding S to it modulo 2 to the 130 minus 5, take M of R mod 2 to the 128. Now I'm relying on my particular notion of numbers in Z mod P, elements of Z mod P being integers between 0 and P minus 1. This is an integer between 0 and 2 to the 130 minus 6. Then we subtract off a few multiples of 2 to the 128, if necessary, to put it in the range 0 through 2 to the 130 minus, 2 to the 128 minus 1. And then take that integer and add S to it, modulo 2 to the 128 again, producing a 128-bit integer A. And maybe I should say that these are all encoded as little endian byte strings. These are all little endian 16-byte little endian strings, which is convenient for the programmer. Both producing R and S, people like the idea of generating 128 random bits, and for communicating A, people like the idea of communicating 128 bits. Now, this sort of tweak, a very easy tweak to do, makes people happy, but what does it do to the security? I have a different function here. and maybe it's not as secure as the original function. I'm no longer doing the m of r plus s mod p, not working in the same ring. I'm working in two different rings, and what happens? Is this actually as secure as the protocol before? You have to redo the security analysis. Which, fortunately, is not hard. If you look at this m of r mod 2 to the 128 and then adding s mod 2 to the 128, there's only tweaking the original m of r plus s by a few 2 to the 128. Let's suppose that we have, as before, let's say that we have an a that matches m. A equals the same, the function I've written down here with m, and a prime is same function with m prime. Then let's look at A. A is m of r mod 2 to the 128, which is, at worst, m of r minus a few 2 to the 128. So let me start on the outside. When we have m of r mod 2 to the 128 and then add s to it, we get a number between 0 and 2 to the 129 minus 1, or 2 to the 129 minus 2, and then mod 2 to the 128 subtracts, at most, 1, 2 to the 128 from it. A is equal to, as an integer, m of r mod 2 to the 128, plus s minus either 0 or 1 times 2 to the 128. A is not equal to that. A is contained in that set. So A is contained in the set of how many 2 to the 128s did we subtract from m? Well, we take m of r and subtract. It's between 0 and 2 to the 130 minus 5. So we subtract at most 3 2 to the 128s from it. And then we add s, and then subtract 0 or 1, 2 to the 128. To summarize, we've subtracted 0, 1, 2, 3, or 4, 2 to the 128 from the integer m of r plus s. And now I want to emphasize this is integer, not mod p. Compute m of r mod p, then take that integer plus s and subtract off a few, one of the few possibilities for a multiple of 2 to the 128, that gives you A. So, subtracting this from A prime, the integer A prime, we get the difference, A minus A prime, is M of R minus M prime of R. The S's cancel, and then we've subtracted and added between 0 and 4 multiples of 2 to the 128. Overall, we've added something between minus 4 and 4 times 2 to the 128. This is true as an integer equation where, again, the m of r's are mod p. Okay, let me just, for absolute clarity, emphasize m of r mod p here, m of r mod p there, m prime of r mod p. Everything else is working in z. Now, this equation, we can reduce mod p. And we see that r is a root, mod p now, of the, well, one of nine possible polynomials, one of the nine non-zero polynomials. Let's see, a minus a prime minus m prime plus the same multiple of minus 4 through 4 times 2 to the 128. Got to be a little careful when I'm saying the non-zero here. Wait a minute, what happens to the constant coefficient, etc.? If you carefully do the analysis, actually, you can get down to there are actually just 8 polynomials, and if you care about the details, then you can look at my paper, which has a paragraph on doing this carefully. The conclusion of this analysis is that the probability of an attack succeeding, the probability of a successful forgery, instead of the L over 2 to the 130 minus 5 we had before, there's now 8L for the possibly L roots of each of the polynomials times 8 polynomials divided by the number of possibilities for R, which is now 2 to the 128. In other words, L over 2 to the 125, which is maybe not quite as impressive, but still an acceptable security level. All right, one further tweak to get to the final Pauli 1305 details. This last change is not something about programmer annoyance or about fundamental message encoding issues. This is just one last slide here, one last piece of the blackboard. This is just about speeding things up. Even though this, at this point, we'd have a working, convenient protocol, but for speed, for reasons that will be obvious later about a really important class of CPUs, for speed on many CPUs, Pauli 1305 actually changes the range of R to be even more restricted than 0 through 2 to the 128 minus 1. Pauli 1305 actually uses a uniform random R of the following form. It's some R0, which will be the bottom 32 bits, but I'll clamp down on it more, plus 2 to the 32 times R1, plus 2 to the 64 times R2, plus 2 to the 96 times R3. Where, what are these R's? Well, if I said each of them is between 0 and 2 to the 32 minus 1, I'd have the same range of R here. But now they're each a few bits more limited. R sub 0 is in the range 0 through 2 to the 28 minus 1. And R sub 1 is the same range and a multiple of 4. Its bottom couple of bits have to be 0. 0, 4, 8, etc. through 2 to the 28 minus 4. And actually, that's not just R1, but R1, R2, and R3 are all multiples of 4, less than 2 to the 28. Overall, we've chopped out a fair number of bits here. 28 sounds pretty close to 32, but there's 4 R's here, and we've lost, 32 versus 28 is 4 bits from each of the R's, from each of the R sub I's, rather. And then we've lost 2 bits from R1, R2, and R3. And let's see if I can count in my head. That was 4 times 4 plus 3 times 2, 6 plus 16. Sounds like 22 bits. And you do the final analysis, and you see, indeed, the probability of a successful attack is less than or equal to L divided by 2 to the 103. L being, as usual, the maximum message degree. Or if you like, it's the number of, maybe I should write this down. This is the maximum number of bytes in the message, maximum number of bytes in the message, divided by 16 gives you the degree, to be precise, rounding up to an integer, and then divided by 2 to the 103, so if you like, it's the number of bytes in the message, divided by 2 to the 107, something a little better than 2 to the 100 for a security level. All right, why are these R's chosen in this way? What is the main major class of CPUs there? Well, the many CPUs are, for instance, the Pentium, Pentium 2, Pentium 3, Pentium 4, Pentium M, the Athlon, Athlon XP, not the Athlon 64, but, well, it's about the same speed on an Athlon 64. As far as I know, the advantages here don't help, but I say that without actually having optimized this particular or improved this particular code for the Athlon 64. In any case, all of the non-64-bit Intel and Athlon, Intel and AMD type CPUs out there are significantly benefited. The code is significantly faster because of these restrictions on R, whereas the security level, as I'll discuss more this afternoon, is still acceptable. With these little tweaks, and then, again, you have to revise the security analysis as you do tweaks like changing the range of R and changing how A is computed, but you can do it without much extra effort. With these tweaks, you have exactly the Pauli 1305 function, which produces from a string of bytes and some 16-byte R and S secrets, it produces a 16-byte authenticator A with a guarantee of security, the probability of an attack succeeding, the probability of a forgery attempt succeeding is negligible. Depending on the L, it's something divided by 2 to the 100 or so. This afternoon, I will jump into the question of how we handle multiple messages, both with and without the protection against eavesdropping. The important part is how do we protect against forgery. The eavesdropping modification is easy, as today. I'll draw the revised channel pictures for that, and then I hope to start a little bit about speed this afternoon, and then tomorrow get much more seriously into speed, and we will see exactly how fast this Poly 1305 function is. Any last questions for the morning? Yeah. Yeah, you could try using something that's around, say, 96 bits, and then try doing something similar. But a lot of the reasons for wanting, for speed reasons, wanting to throw away these 20-something bits, a lot of the speed reasons for doing that are things that apply equally to if you tried to reduce your prime, then you would want to further restrict the Rs for a quite noticeable speed up. And the speed up that happens here because of the restrictions on R is, as far as I know, better than the speed up you can get by switching to a smaller prime. Having said that, yeah, looking at this at the security level, you can imagine lots of different functions that achieve a similar security level. I mentioned yesterday that there were a couple of competitors to this function in the literature, and if you get sort of all the other details of how to do this type of function right, and then you start varying things like exactly how do we choose the prime and exactly how do we choose these R's, then it's certainly possible that you'll get a speed up. This, what I'm writing down is the state of the art function. It's the best that anybody's done so far, but I certainly don't mean to suggest that it's not possible to achieve even better speeds with more work. And I did mention when I was talking about the competitors, one of those, UMAC, achieves better speed than Poly 1305 for long messages on a Pentium 4. And there's another one, VMAC, which achieves really good speeds on an Athlon 64. I don't like optimizing for particular processors at the expense of other processors that people have a lot of. Those functions are slow on, say, an Athlon non-64 on a Pentium 4, Pentium 3, but they still raise the hope that you could do consistently better than Poly 1305. And I certainly don't want to suggest that the current state of the art is the end of the story. It's certainly something that's good, and we'll see how good the performance is, but you can certainly hope to tweak lots of things and do even better. All right, other questions about what the definition of Poly 1305 is or the security? Anything other than multiple messages? I don't see any hands being raised, so I will see everybody in 3 hours, and we will look at how Poly 1305 protects multiple messages and then start getting into speed.